Herzlich willkommen zu Executive Stories, dem Podcast über die Werdegänge von Berliner Führungspersönlichkeiten aus der Medien- und Digitalwirtschaft. Unsere Aufgabe ist es, herauszufinden, was sie antreibt, bewegt und welche Erfahrungen und Anekdoten sie an uns weitergeben können. Executive Stories ist ein Podcast von Medianet Berlin-Brandenburg, produziert mit freundlicher Unterstützung von Cluster IKT, Medien- und Kreativwirtschaft und der Deutschen Telekom. Viel Spaß beim Anhören.
Hi there and welcome to Executive Stories. My name is Simon Older and today, as you can hear, we have another English episode. Today I'm speaking to Mark Bate from AWS GameTech. That's Amazon's cloud-based product that helps developers bring their games to life through various sorts of technology, AI, machine learning, all the products that game developers don't want to develop themselves, but instead want to rely on tried and tested services for. And that is what Mark does in his day to day. But at night, so to speak, and probably also during the day, he is a community leader. Mark has been in Berlin working at various startups for a couple of years now, and he has built user groups that connect users and developers of services, products, and the like of over 3,000 members and helped these people get in contact with each other and all do a better job. The users kind of at using the product, so they have more joy and effectivity using products, and the developers making the products better for the users. So Mark is a great facilitator, a catalyst, and yeah, overall great guy and advisor to many startups, and really a product focused guy. And the great thing is he's also a gamer, and so we talk a lot about the future of games. That's what I was really curious about, and how games will have already affected technology and how they will develop. For example, Mark also worked on Alexa, and yeah, we talk about how audio will affect games in the future. But that's enough from me for now. Please listen to this episode. I hope you enjoy it. So relax, sit back, and enjoy this episode of Executive Stories with Mark Bate. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Simon.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for having us. We're here at Amazon in Berlin. Yep. And you are a solutions architect for AWS GameTech, right?
Yes, correct.
And so that's not the part of Amazon that actually develops the games. That would be AGS, but it's mm-hmm. the part that, or a part of Amazon's cloud department, if you can say that, AWS, yep. Which builds technology for other video game developers.
Uh-huh, correct.
They are supposed to use it, or they may use it, and your mission is to help bring their games to life.
Yeah, so I mean, AWS builds the core technology, so things like EC2 for virtual compute instances, things like RDS for databases, things like S3 for storage. Many people are familiar with those. There's a few services also specific for games, so things like GameLift, which does your kind of game server hosting. It also does things like matchmaking and so on, that we kind of also help developers understand those and use them. So our whole kind of mission as the game tech team is helping developers build, scale, and operate their games. So whatever it takes to kind of do those things.
And so can you give some examples of, games that are running, let's say, their matchmaking or scoreboards via AWS?
Yes. So, I mean, something that quite a lot of people know, probably Fortnite. That's a massive game. I'm sure probably you may have played a few rounds. I know kind of everybody out there. I've got tons of friends. I know tons of kids that are playing it as well.
It's colloquial knowledge. We don't need to explain Fortnite. If a listener doesn't know Fortnite, then they're invited to Google.
Yes. They're running completely on AWS. So that's everything from their game servers to, their matchmaking for those game servers. They run their analytics to better understand their games. they run kind of, all of the operations for getting that game up and running as well. So a lot of stuff there that they're doing to kind of better understand the game and keep the game running over time. Mm. I mean, it's been running for several years now, and they've been iterating with new seasons, just kind of learning from how players play and keep fine-tuning those things.
Yes. And they are also cross-platform, right? And you probably help facilitate that as well, which is, I think, a huge, unique part of Fortnite.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't personally work on with the Fortnite, but I know that we do have team members in the US that do work with them that help them on these aspects. Yeah,
just to give an idea of what AWS Game Tech is doing is why we're explaining this. Yeah. And what's on your mind right now? What are you usually working on, or what problems are you trying to solve right now? And just to give us a kind of overview, and we will get more into it later on.
Okay. So my main focus is, at least from what I see from customers, are they're wanting to run game servers for their multiplayer games. Some of them are also kind of like indie devs that just want to add things like scoreboards or player login or like storing data in some way. So they might be using databases or some lightweight services like API gateway to spin up APIs. There are things like analytics pipelines. So as you're kind of running a game longer term, you want to kind of understand, first off, what's your daily and monthly active users? What's your average revenue per user? Things like that. But you also want to understand, like, what are the actual ways that players engage with your game? So what does their kills, deaths, assists look like? Which items are they picking up? Where are they getting stuck in, like, level 7? These kind of things. So you can use those to fine-tune your game or coach the player to get better, those kind of things. There's things like machine learning to start doing things like churn prediction on one side and kind of in improving the player experience in there. But we also have customers like Rovio that have started playing around with reinforcement learning, which is essentially where you throw a bot into a level and you kind of teach it this is a good thing and you give it a reward for that, and you teach it this is a bad thing and you give it negative points for that. And so they're using that to kind of QA a lot of their levels. And they were able to produce a lot more levels per week. I think it's gone from 2 to 40 just by using a lot of this reinforcement learning in the first place.
So it's really about giving developers a better understanding of their own game and their player base.
Yes.
And I think that's a very new thing in gaming, where it's not just, you know, slap a finished product onto a CD, give it to the customer and let them, you know, figure it out, which is a beautiful process too. But today it's really, like you said, iterative back and forth between producer of the game, developer, and customer.
Yes.
And the data that flows between them that nobody really sees, but you actually help them see that. You bring that to life for the developer.
Yeah, as you say, like previously games, I mean, okay, they have been kind of collecting analytics for a while, but I mean, the games were essentially kind of, okay, we released this idea that we think is good. We've maybe done some playtesting beforehand, but like we release this, we think it's good. And if it works, then we release a new version that's slightly changed and keep going from that. And eventually kind of these trends pick up in the industry, and that's where you get everybody releasing a platformer, everybody releasing a battle royale, everybody releasing a Dark Souls clone, these kind of things, which can be really good. But also like you want to kind of make these games unique as well. So having those metrics in there so that you can fine tune it to your player experience helps a lot.
I think that's a great way to put it into a few words, what exactly you're on about. And I would really like to get to know you a little bit better and where you're coming from. And then I want to deep dive a bit with you into the meaning of those topics, what that means for games and tech and so on. But for now, before we explore these potentials of technology and video games with you, I really would like to know who you are, and maybe we can start at the beginning. How and where did you grow up?
Okay. So I'm originally from the UK. I grew up there till I was about 10 or 11. And then I ended up moving over to Australia because my parents found work over there. So we moved over there. I think I was there for like a year and a half, and then I bounced back to the UK And then I bounced back to Australia again. And so I've kind of grown up between the UK and Australia, and I have both aspects of that. That's why my accent is all messed up. For anybody listening, hi. So I think there's kind of those things there. When I was in Australia, I got more into like art and design side. So science was always a curiosity, but I was very much drawn to like art and design. And so I started out as kind of a designer, working on graphic design things, and then got into like multimedia design as well. So
before we go into your career, I'm really curious at what age and in which way you came in contact with video games.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that probably sort of started when I was about 5 or 6. So I know my dad was working on a book at the time. And I would kind of, I kind of figured out through watching him how to turn on his Amstrad computer and start messing around. And that's
that
when
doesn't
I,
seem, that doesn't sound like that was sanctioned though.
No, that was a kind of like, I saw my dad do it. And then when he was out of the room, I went and kind of turned it on and started playing around. So obviously like he noticed some extra files on the floppy disk he was saving to. And he's like, this is a bit weird. Mark, is this you? So I got my own floppy disk to play around with. And like, I started playing with like word processors, and that's maybe not the most traditional game, but that's kind of how I got into computers.
I remember sitting at my grandpa's computer and really enjoying a specific type of screensaver a lot.
That's cool.
Kind of like, was kind of
is
like,
this like the toaster one or the one with the pipes and those kind of things?
They fascinated me, but this particular one, I've only seen this on my grandpa's computer, and it was some kid, how would you say that, like putting posters on a wall, like
okay.
with the brush and stuff, like
yep.
brushing up like an advertisement wall or something.
That's
and
cool.
It also had this repetitive aspect to it, but I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I've never seen it again.
Yeah, I've never seen that one.
Must have been some type of custom thing that my grandpa found. But yeah, there are. Cool. It's a funny thing, right? Like
yep.
the computer itself is like an invitation to play. And I mean, I played tons with Microsoft Word. You probably were earlier than Microsoft Word.
I don't even remember what the program was called, but yeah, it was an early word processor like back in the day. And then, I mean, I started with that, but then I did kind of play on my granddad's like Tandy computer as well, and started playing a whole load of games with him and my grandma, which was really cool. You got to play things like Quick Draw and like those old kind of like, you know, blocky graphics where you move around simple mazes and find the things, those things. And then when I was about 8, my parents bought me an Atari ST, the 520 STE, and that's where I played pretty much all my games from then on. So your things like Monkey Island, Dragon's Breath, Super Cycle, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Zool, like a whole lot of these games that I was just nerding out on. I eventually got a Nintendo as well, but I think I kind of started playing on the Atari.
So. Yeah, that's very nice. And I remember you also told me that you used to play with your sister a lot, right? And you kind of went through, maybe you can tell a story.
Yeah. So, I mean, my sister is like 2.5 years younger than me. So, and then I have other siblings that are about 8 years younger than me. So it was kind of me and my sister playing the Atari quite a lot in terms of like just passing the controller back and forth, trying to beat each other. And then when we got the Nintendo, you know, you can play Mario like 2 players. So it was kind of like, I love this kind of aspect of like you play and then you watch a sibling play or a friend play or whatever. You learn from this and you can kind of help them go, no, don't hit that. That's the bad block. Or, oh, go down there. There's a secret. Or like, you know, when you first discover the concept of warp whistles in Mario 3 or something like that, and you kind of like, what does this do? Let's try it out. Or where does the secret vine go? All of that kind of stuff that you can learn from each other.
And you were peaceful, it sounds like.
Mostly. We got on pretty well as siblings. But yeah, of course, there's sometimes you steal each other's toys and those kind of things.
Of course. And it's, I think it's a beautiful thing to this way of playing with a video game. I mean, you said you were just drawn to it naturally, it seems like.
Yeah.
And like so many of us, and to share it with somebody like a sibling and in this equal way, and then also looking at the same game together, trying to beat it together, are, you know, trying to one-up each other. I think it's a wonderful way to play.
The really cool thing I saw on Facebook, it must have been like a year or so back now, but my sister, she's over in Australia, that's why I'm seeing her on Facebook, but she's telling me like her son kind of came to her and said, "Mommy, I want to show you like a Nintendo game." And she's like, "Okay, I'll watch." And it was Mario 1. And she's like, "I'm going to show you how to," or he's going to show her how to play. And she's like, "No, I'm going to show you how to play." It's kind of cool.
You don't even know what I know.
Exactly.
That's beautiful. I think that's a rare connection. You know, not that many, like in our generation, I think, well, we like you just described, you're like a proto gamer, earliest games, basically.
Uh-huh.
And there's no way that your parents, and even in my case, my parents had no real connection to that. So there wasn't this depth of understanding.
Yeah.
Just to imagine your nephew, I guess, you know, recognizing a shared interest with his mom like that. That's so valuable.
That's cool. Yeah.
So. Mm, it's beautiful. So you were in touch with these games, like always in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Did your moving back and forth that you described have anything? Do you think that affected you at all? Was it?
I think it kind of gave me a wider view of the world.
Mm.
Like I think, of course, when you grow up in one place, like all you kind of know is that place. Like you don't know what's happening on the other side of the world. And where I grew up in Coventry in the UK, it's a nice city. It's kind of known for its universities these days. It's where like Jaguar Motors came from. It's a bit rough around the edges. But like it's an okay kind of UK city in the middle kind of thing.
Okay, UK.
Yeah. whereas you go to Australia and it's like, I mean, it's way sunnier every day. Like UK, just like every time you go there, it's kind of gray. It's probably going to rain that day. It's, you know, like, I like the UK, but yeah,
what the weather is not the weather best today. It's probably going to rain. I think you're right.
Yeah. But you go to Australia and you look outside and it's always sunny. I mean, Melbourne has a few days of rain as well, but like it's still kind of way sunnier weather, way nicer. Like the climate's closer to what we're having in Berlin at the moment, where it's kind of late 20s to 30s, kind of most of the summer. So that's always nice. And you have like big open spaces, all that kind of thing. And of course, people kind of are similar in Australia, but think differently, like just different things that are on top of their mind. And now moving back to Berlin, they think differently as well. And like, it's just kind of, you get a whole experience of how different cultures think and how they interact with each other. It kind of gives you a wider picture of things.
Yeah. And then you mentioned, I think you were in Australia at the time you started your career as an art designer.
Yeah. So I studied, I think it was arts multimedia back then. I think the course has changed names a little bit, but I was kind of working on that. I was working on like things like Director and Flash and so on. Started out doing that, building websites. I knew how to make the front end look pretty. I didn't quite know how the back end works. So then I started studying web development, software development. And that's how I kind of got into like science in a sense. So I was working for Monash University in their protein structure and function department. Helping them build websites for scientific research. So kind of classifying things or running data science tools or running grid computing, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
So.
And so you basically moved from being an art and design person into more a sciencey thing, a tinkery thing.
Yeah.
As a gamer, it seems pretty natural to discover that because it's also very playful nature, correct?
It's this whole kind of like, it is kind of like a game where you're kind of drawn into it and you're like, there's a secret over there and I want to go find out how it is, or like maybe there's an Easter egg here. So you start kind of exploring the whole thing of science. And I went from just building websites to operating the servers to eventually like building compute clusters for our teams. And I started understanding things like grid computing, which was kind of cloud computing was just taking off at the same time, but being able to kind of farm jobs out to many instances that could kind of do the processing instead of running them on one computer, change things. Like,
so that basically means that you connect a bunch of computers together, and they work on the same problem with, you know,
yeah,
combining all the processing power.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the examples I had was kind of, we were trying to find out the structure of a protein based on, like, we'd taken it to a synchrotron, which is essentially a large kind of magnet that shoots X-rays at something, and they bounce off and they give you all these pretty dots on a backboard, but you lose kind of the phase of the wave that you're actually shooting across. So you need to kind of recalculate that.
Yeah.
So we were basically taking the entire known human protein structure set and farming that out to grids, and probably doing, I don't know, maybe a few years worth of work in a few hours.
Whoa, that's so cool.
So yeah, it was kind of cool. And being able to kind of get those things happening fast was a lot of fun.
And you taught all of that yourself?
Yeah, pretty much. Kind of, there was a few friends that were in the space already, and I kind of chatted to those and said, show me how to do this or show me how to operate these things. But yeah, most of it was kind of me falling in the deep end and then figuring out how to swim.
Ah. So it's like you're a self-taught, full stack developer in a way, right? You went from the front end to the back end to back end.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's so cool. And where did you go next?
So I was there for a while. I built grid computers, was operating those, teaching scientists how to use them for drug design and all that kind of stuff and solving their protein structures. And then unfortunately, like, university funding is year to year, and my lab manager didn't get the funding for my position. So I started going out into the startup world. I went to a startup called Macintosh, who do scientific software. Initially, it was for Mac and iOS, and they've started to branch out to Android and Windows now. But the main thing I worked on was a thing called Papers, which is kind of like iTunes for your journal articles. So if you're writing a PhD thesis or something like that, you download a ton of PDFs.
Yeah.
They end up all over your hard drive.
It's terrible.
Yes. So you bring them into this application. It kind of reads the metadata of them, uploads that to the cloud, downloads any metadata that's missing, and then you have a searchable library of all of these kind of things. And it has a little tool that makes it easier to cite inside your paper as well.
Also very important, because you don't want to type that out yourself.
Yes. So, I mean, the company was acquired and they've changed it up a bit since, but I think most of the core features are still there. Mm. But yeah, it was kind of a cool tool for doing that kind of stuff. I did that for maybe a year and a half, maybe a bit longer. And then I was after a new challenge, and that's when I discovered Wunderlist. So I moved to Berlin, Germany for that. I joined Six Wunderkinder, the company that makes it.
Which is a to-do list app, which has since been acquired, right?
It was acquired by Microsoft in 2015, I think. Yes. And sadly, it was kind of shut down, I think, about a month or so back. They migrated the users across to Microsoft To Do. But yes, it was a cross-platform to-do app that was on pretty much every device that you could think of.
Yeah.
Had really fast sync. So like I know people that used it that would kind of go into a supermarket as a couple, and they'd have a shopping list on the app, and like one of them would run down one aisle and another would run down the other aisle, and they're just checking it off back and forth, and it was syncing across their phones, telling them that like all the things had been picked up, and cool. Then like they could just run to the checkout together. So that was kind of cool.
What did you build there?
So I was kind of doing the operations side of stuff. So keeping the servers running, making sure that the sync stayed fast, a little bit of back-end development. But I was mostly kind of keeping the servers up and running and kind of expanding it for Wunderlist 1 and then the second version, Wunderlist 2.
Mm.
So.
What drove you from science... from the science and academia world to the startup world, and what from then on, mm-hmm. what kind of made you do that?
I think the main thing is I was just curious about new stuff, and I really kind of wanted to help improve something that I used every day or that I knew really well. So things like Papers and Wunderlist, I was using them pretty often.
Oh,
So it was more a case of like, I really like these tools. I specifically searched out companies. So when I was looking for new jobs, I didn't just go through the job sites and go, I want to be a Java developer somewhere or something.
Let's see
like that.
Who needs a Java developer. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was more a case of like, I'm going to troll the job boards of companies I'm interested in. I'm going to kind of reach out to friends of those companies, see if they're hiring. And it was just the right timing for those. I think my last two or three jobs I've got through Twitter DMs.
Straight up.
Which has kind of worked out well. So yeah, it was kind of like branching out into those areas. And I mean, it's sort of the same reason I joined Amazon. I saw a big challenge there. I saw something that I was using kind of every day and that was quite useful to others.
And what was that?
So you mean in terms of Amazon or in terms of just in general?
Yeah, no, you said you were specifically at Amazon, you saw something.
I joined AWS initially on the, well, I was one of the early solutions architects working with startups. So I was helping like, you know, I'd come from a startup here in Berlin and I was helping kind of former peers at other startups build and scale their ideas. So it was very much a kind of, I understood this world and I understood the services and I wanted to help others kind of do that. So that's kind of what drove me there. And of course, like you're closer to the technology, you act as kind of not just someone that's helping improve for the customers, but also someone that's taking the feedback from the customers and driving that to the service teams of like, we would really like, I remember like RDS Postgres was a huge thing that my customers were asking for. So when it finally launched at reInvent, I think that was 2013 or 2014, I know, like I personally pinged a whole load of developers. I was like, it's finally here. You get to play with it. This will help you sleep at night. You know, kind of. So I think it was like super useful to kind of be able to drive those in both ways.
Yeah. So if I understood you right, so in the technical terms, you know, I have no idea what exactly you just spoke about.
Sorry, RDS, yes.
Postgres, but I mean, I've heard that, but I don't know what it means, but just in a sense that a new tool was launched and you kind of, propagated the news through your network.
Yes. So, sorry. It's a database engine. And this is a service that essentially runs it in a managed form. So without that, you basically have to boot up your EC2 instances, so your computer instances, install the software yourself, manage the backups yourself, manage like failover, anything like that. So this kind of gives you a whole service that manages that.
Exactly.
So
and you went around and had all these connections built between the service and the developers. That was kind of this in-between facilitation role that you fulfilled?
Not directly. It was more a case of like, I knew these customers wanted this and I gave the feedback to the service team. They were probably already working on this, but at least they knew now the needs of these specific developers.
I see. And that's what brought you to Amazon to work on these services that you already used on the startup side. You wanted to get closer to that.
Yeah, be closer to that and to help others kind of build their ideas on top of it. So, I mean, I work closely with many startups here in Berlin, as well as many accelerators and incubators, and work with their startups. So you've got these startups that are basically fresh out of the garage or fresh out of the coffee shop that have just formed, and you're kind of helping them validate their idea and then pointing them towards a tech stack that may help them, and just kind of being there to kind of play the rubber duck to their questions that they may have. And that really helps them. I mean, you see so many startups that have kind of come out of that and you're like, I remember chatting to them when they were about 3 weeks old. That's nice. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that must feel like a proud dad, like proud startup dad or a helpful uncle type of situation. And just to explain the term rubber duck, very, very important. It's when you, let me know if that's right, but it's basically when you, most of the time you try to figure out a problem and you can't solve it.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to ask another person and then they don't give you the solution. But in that moment, you find your own solution.
Yeah.
And so the joke is kind of that you just should put a little yellow rubber duck next to your thing and ask the duck, which in turn will make you find out your own solution.
Yeah,
and exactly. That's the role you played of kind of just a facilitator, somebody who's there for people to run through their questions.
Yeah.
And did you manifest this activity in any type of community, or did mm-hmm. you scale that in any way?
So, I mean, yeah, that's a good thing to bring up as well. So, I mean, there was also kind of working with the startups one-on-one or one-to-incubator kind of thing. But also kind of after hours, I was also working with initially Nokia to spin up user groups here in Berlin. So there was a Berlin AWS user group. It's still going, actually. And as far as I know, they meet, well, when it's not Corona times, they meet every month. I'm not kind of sure on their current cadence. So that kind of spun up. That very quickly got to sort of about 50 members that were meeting like every month. Then we kind of saw that there was a need for one in Munich as well. So we helped Markus Ostertag, one of our community heroes now, set up down there. He's got a bit bigger, actually. I think he's now got like 100 and something that meet every month. But that's really cool. Then we helped with Hamburg. And then we just kind of kept spreading from there. So I think in the 2.5 years that I was initially on the AWS team, we got to something like 3,000 members on Meetup in about 16 groups around Germany and Austria, wow. Which is just kind of crazy. It's crazy numbers just to think about it, but it's really cool to have those developers connected to each other, able to solve each other's problems. I mean, they're all kind of working on similar challenges, coming from different industries, that kind of thing. But, you know, this person's having a problem with EC2. This person knows how to solve it. So they can help each other move a lot faster in those ways. And they can give each other interesting talks or interesting ideas. Some of them hack on things together. It's kind of a cool concept, I think.
Yeah, it's beautiful to bring peers together like that. And it, you know, it requires some sort of dedication from somebody like you who did that to just say, well, I just want to have these people meet, you know, and mm-hmm. I know that if that happens, something good will happen.
Yeah.
And it seems like this was your whole time, your motivation to, it seems like you hopped always to the place where you were needed the most in a way.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I just kind of find gaps and jump into them, I guess.
Yeah.
And kind of scale out from those ways. So, I mean, it wasn't just me that was doing the meetup stuff. It was mostly ran by community. And also like the startup team here in Berlin helped a lot with that kind of stuff as well. But yeah, like stepping into that and helping connect those leaders, helping them scale out, helping make sure that they had content, helping make sure that they knew what to do if something went wrong or that they had venues to speak in. Those kind of things, yeah.
Yeah. And now, you know, you've gone from artist to engineer,
mm-hmm.
more or less self-taught.
Yeah.
You've gone from academia in Australia to the startup world in Berlin and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
There are basically tons of places where you could go, and you have a habit of, you know, selecting a specific place, like you said.
Yeah.
And now you're at Amazon GameStack, and it yeah. seems like, as far as I've heard from you, it's very close to like your core mission. It seems like you're in the right place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I went from the startup team and actually found another secret project that was happening that eventually became Alexa launching in UK and Germany.
Mm.
And so I worked on that.
Another secret.
Yeah. not a secret anymore. Like, it's definitely out there. Many people are kind of using Alexa devices. Yes. You know, I have quite a few at home. I'm sure quite a few in this building as well. So I worked mostly with like third-party developers. So a lot of the folks that are building skills for Alexa, helping them get up and running and help support our various launches of devices. So the various kind of Echoes, Echo Shows, Echo Dots, all of those kind of things. And so I did that for a while. And then as we kind of grew out the team, I could focus a bit more on voice games. So I could start exploring like how voice could be used for games ideas. And that's kind of what drove me into the curiosity about games. And that's kind of why I've stepped over to game tech now. So I'm just kind of curious about games in general. I've got all this experience from like the startup world of like moving fast and building these things and scaling to like crazy levels, like tens of millions of users, those kind of things. So I think a lot of that also applies to games as well. So that's kind of why I'm in this space. And also like it's one of those things I like to do in my spare time as well. I play a ton of games. So going into kind of working with games customers is definitely interesting. I mean, there's a ton of different other kind of verticals that we work with as well. But I mean, I don't know too many people that go home and go, I want to fire up a Excel spreadsheet and get excited about my finances or something like that. I love kind of being in games for that reason, in terms of like, there's customers that I'm working with now that I know I will play their games when they come out. So
let's talk a little bit about that. Let's see, what is it about games, and how do games and technology kind of work in tandem? It seems like they are so closely interlinked.
So on the consumer side, like, games have pretty much driven a lot of the advances that you get in hardware. Like, as we said before, we started out on kind of word processors, and word processors were kind of the killer app for PCs for a long time, until games kind of came around. And then you had kind of games like Doom and like all of these kind of things that started pushing hardware requirements. And people kind of upgrade their computers now, not because they want to run bigger databases or bigger Word files or something like that. It's because they want to play the latest, greatest games. Same reason you may buy a PS5 or an Xbox Series X or the next Nintendo when it comes out. You want to play the latest, greatest games. So I think there's that side on the consumer side, but on the back-end side, there's a whole load of stuff there. Like, even a single-player game can use a ton of different technologies. So things like scoreboards, yeah, they can definitely run as a database and a few APIs to get those up and running. You've suddenly got kind of a challenge to your game that you had even back in the arcade days, you know, when you went along, you took your 25 cents or whatever it was, 50 cents to play the game. And you put your like three letters in the high score table. You can do that again now, like with kind of cloud databases and APIs and that kind of stuff.
It affects a lot more people. You know, you're not just playing against your local arcade homies. You're playing against the whole world.
Yeah.
So it's the greatest challenge possible.
Exactly. So I mean, when you're playing half of these games, they might even be indie games. So there's, I don't know how many thousands, millions of people playing them. But like, you just have this kind of leaderboard of like everybody that's in that level. And you're kind of like, I'm the greatest person in the world at this level, or I'm the second greatest and I want to beat the first greatest. And
Important to find these points of competition. I mean, we have it through esports, which is pretty organized, but you also have it in the small versions like speedrunning, which is basically arbitrary goals that you set to play through a game in a very low amount of time.
Yeah.
And then there are, you know, community run scoreboards to see who's the best at that. So the competition is always there for all gamers. And to have that technology that enables that is key, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned it. What's, you know, we've been in the current console and like console cycle for about 7 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned PS5, Xbox Series X, a new generation is coming out. And with it, there's also a generation coming out with new ways of consumption, like streaming games.
Yeah.
Streaming games to consumers via the likes of Twitch.
Yeah.
Streaming games to your computer from a cloud-based service, so you don't have to run the game on your own computer anymore.
Yeah.
There is VR. You mentioned audio and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What are we entering into right now in terms of new game lifecycle? What will games be like during the next 10 years or so?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think, and it's very hard to predict, but I think the things that we're going to see, definitely a lot of kind of player-driven development of the game. So in terms of like understanding how players play these and refining that over time. And then I think we're going to see a lot of experimentation with hardware. So I think VR is still a bit of a curiosity. There's a few games out there that are awesome for it. I've not played Half-Life Alyx, but I've heard that's really cool. I've played Astrobot Rescue Mission on the PSVR. That's super awesome. If you haven't played that, definitely play. It's like my favorite VR game. There's things like Superhot in VR. There's I'm thinking of the dancing one. You know, the one with the lightsabers?
Beat Saber.
That's it, yes. So all of these kind of games that are really cool that I think is it's very early there. And I think people are starting to try to understand the VR space and trying to find the next hit. I think there's kind of the aspect of like cross-platform or cross-play in terms of not just the whole, how do I bring my whole account, but also like the social side of that. Like, okay, my friend might be playing on one platform, but I want to play them on another platform. How do we kind of share achievements? How do we share things like messaging, all of that kind of stuff? And then I think there's the whole keeping players engaged with your game, even when they're not physically at the device. So as you said kind of before, streaming may touch into that space because it suddenly means that you can take your mobile phone and go play while you're on the train or like something like that on your way to work. But I think there's also things like, so especially from like my experience in the voice game space, I saw a couple of developers like Bungie and Activision build skills that would let you take small actions inside Destiny 2 and also Call of Duty. So the Destiny 2 would let you kind of check which friends were online or change your loadouts or kind of what's your next mission, that kind of stuff. And I think the Call of Duty one would basically coach you to get your KDA up. So your kills, deaths, and assists. Like how do you get better at that? So I think there's those aspects, but especially now that like the Echo team have kind of brought out the Echo Buds and the Echo Auto. So the Buds are the headphones and the Auto is the one in the car, which connect to your mobile phone and then can use things like GPS. So I think you have a kind of always on connection that way. So imagine you're kind of driving home from work or you're on the U-Bahn on the way home from work and you're able to kind of check in, live what's happening in Destiny 2 or like what's happening in this game or like a persistent online world where you could kind of take actions and say, have my crops finished growing yet? Am I under attack? Do I need to do this? That's much faster than like the current process where you need to kind of boot your PC up, wait the 2 minutes for Windows to start up, download all the Windows updates, because I'm sure there's Windows updates, start Steam, wait for the Steam update, start the game, eventually get into the game, and 5 minutes later, there's no changes, everything's good, thanks. Okay, I can go back to what I'm doing. But I remember as we chatted before, there was old like browser games that you needed to check in like once per day or something to make sure
if you're serious about it a bit more often.
But these kind of things are now very easy to do via voice.
And it's fascinating that browser games who basically are, and you had this joke, but they are basically glorified Excel tables that are, you know, have some prohibitive elements to turn them into a game.
Mm-hmm.
They have an aura of boringness because they are, you know, they don't have any graphical interface really. So, and of course there's excitement through player on player interaction, fights and so on, fight timings, blah, blah, blah. But it's so funny pairing such an old and, you know, boring quote unquote thing with audio. Suddenly seems to be able to bring a whole new world to life. Like you said, you know, you can be in the U-Bahn or whatever and constantly interact with this world and just through audio and a good audio AI that speaks to you like Alexa, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it boggles my mind.
Even if you have like a regular Echo, you can still do this in your living room.
Obviously, yes.
You can then also open up the experience to everybody that you live with. So instead of being like you on a single computer focused there, maybe you kind of get like your housemates or your kids or your spouse involved kind of thing. And kind of, it's not just you playing as an individual, it's you playing as a family. And then it's kind of like, maybe we should kind of invade this opponent or, build this kind of resource.
You're like yelling at your daughter. It's like, take out the trash and invade the opponents.
Yes.
do your household duties. That's hilarious. Yeah. And it makes it persistent for many other people too. And it's really just, I mean, what you perceive in the world, you know, is just what you put kind of in front of you. So if you sit in the front of the computer, you know, you have a game, you know, that's what you're kind of zoomed into in that moment. But audio can make this weirdly accessible to many people. And so you can share kind of, you know, I think a lot of this future gaming space is about virtual rooms, which, for example, we talked about Fortnite, they're already doing that. So they're putting, you know, concerts into the game. So whichever, you know, everybody who's going into a game, there's only the single game mode in a way in Fortnite, has the chance to, at that time, not shoot each other, but go to like a concert by Travis Scott, or like see the new Star Wars trailer on a billboard. And it's like this virtual room characteristic that even when there's not such an event on, you know, people are still meeting there and, you know, duking it out, but also having fun and waving at each other and so on. And it seems like, funnily enough, through audio specifically, it has this way into the real world now more than ever.
Yeah, I think it definitely opens it up stuff. Like as you're talking there, I'm also thinking about like games like EVE Online.
Yeah.
Where you like every couple of months or so you read about like massive battles where like one faction has done something to annoy another faction, and you suddenly get like thousands of players attack each other, and like wars that go on for like days or weeks.
And it's like this type of headline that's like, you may never heard of this game, but there are like, as you can translate the in-game currency into a real currency through the through these player cards that allow you game time, they're like, there were actually $600,000 in damages or something like that in this virtual. Yeah.
But I like also like, you know how on Alexa you can do what's my flash briefing, or like what are my notifications, or those kind of things.
Yeah.
Like maybe you could do those kind of things with like, what's my flash briefing? It's like, well, this clan has invaded this clan, and you know, these things are under attack. These kind of sectors are high risk right now. These ones are this, and blah, blah, blah. And maybe you could just get a flash briefing on what's going on in your game.
Yeah. And that would really put you there. That's what I mean with the perception. Yeah. You put that in front of you. You're really in there, even in your daily life. And I mean, I think this can have huge effects. I mean, as the news cycle of the real world gets increasingly confusing and depressing and doesn't seem to have so much to do with anything other than itself. It's like this weird game that's going on. Why don't you just put on, I don't know, news from Hyrule, like the Zelda world, or, you know, EVE Online? And I don't think it's clear that one has more value than the other, that one is more, you know, like, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't be connected to what's happening in the real world in a way, but like the way most people consume news seems somewhat unhealthy and over the top. And, you know, you might as well feed yourself with things that are, you know, fun, like games.
Yeah, I guess most people's kind of news consumption comes like third or fourth hand via social networks or something like that. So Twitter, it's kind of been like they've played telephone in the way, and it's like, this is what's actually happening in the news, and this is what you see maybe sensationalized in some way, or this is kind of the soundbite that you hear.
Yeah.
So I guess kind of if you can do that to something that you enjoy, like games, then there's a benefit to it as well. Like just being able to get a soundbite of like, what's the latest speedrun time on the messenger or
Dead Cells? There are no bad news there. There are only good news. Like why not have that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, it's a very, I mean, you mentioned earlier I asked you about the new generation, and it's about, you know, cross-platform accessibility to many people have accessibility to the same game. And it used to be specifically not like that. You know, many people had PCs, but then PCs had also have like an, let's say, upper class or like, you know, higher middle class intellectual factor. And many communities in the world were more like a TV type of household. And then so you would more plug a console in, and you see that in game communities where let's say console player communities and PC communities are vastly like different in their how they are socialized. And now these cross-platform things can really bridge that and bring things together.
I think there will still be some aspect of like loyalists to certain platforms, but I think there will be people that play across everything. Like I have half of the things set up at home. And so like, I specifically love things like the Witcher 3, which has kind of the login with, I think it's GOG. And then you can play
good old games.
Then you can kind of transfer your progress across from like the Switch to the PC to the PlayStation to all of these things. So if you have the game on everything, you can just keep continuing on the quest from there. So I think I would love that aspect of it as well. But I think personally, what I see is kind of the next step that we'll see there is going beyond kind of just screens. So I think, yeah, going into this space where you play on your mobile, you play on your voice, you do all of this kind of stuff where you're not kind of tied to just being at sitting on the couch or sitting in front of the PC. Like, I think they will try and keep people involved in games.
Yeah. This pervasiveness we were talking about. So interesting. And let's talk a little bit about how what you do with the technology that you develop now actively, and this what we already touched on in the intro, that basically game developers are now having a much more iterative approach mm-hmm. to game development than they used to. So again, it used to be you build a game, you test as much as you can, and then you release it, and it will always have some bugs and so on. Some make the charm of the game, some break the game. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can release a patch via the internet if it's, you know, not too big because of bandwidth limits, blah, blah. This is all like my kind of gamer days 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's all via platform. It's all being updated like sometimes daily, weekly, monthly. Mm-hmm. There's a much more iterative process. And you mentioned earlier too, it's kind of like this copycat thing. Not in a bad way. It's just like, well, a battle royale type of game becomes very popular. Okay. Yep. So now everybody, like suddenly there's a user base, right? So everybody mm-hmm. develops a battle royale. Same with Dark Souls. Everybody wants to make a Souls-like because it's just what's going on there? These are like convergences, I feel, into these single things that's driven through data. Isn't that bad? Won't we all see the same all the time now? Or what's going on?
I don't necessarily think so. So, I mean, obviously that's driven by some kind of sales data or, you know, how often these things top the Twitch charts or something like that. Like, in terms of like, how visible is this game, both through sales or both through like streaming, as in watching, those kind of things. Totally fine to do that. And I think we will still see some of that. But I think this also opens up the aspect of if you can get the data quick, it's very easy to experiment and fail fast. So let's say I have an idea that just isn't out there at the moment. I don't know, like...
A game where a bunch of beans run around and they fall down.
Exactly.
And then, oh, wait, actually, that's there
that
now.
That came out like last week.
Yeah, damn.
Okay, let's say not beans. Let's say rice, okay?
Okay, rice.
A game about rice running around and trying to... Yeah, but let's say I throw this out there and I think it'll work and my colleagues think it'll work, but we don't know yet if it will work to the public because we've done playtesting with friends and family and maybe like a controlled audience or something like that, but we haven't done playtesting with the entire world. But if you kind of look at things like early access now, if you have the analytics that are set up there, you can get very fast feedback on like what's going on, like almost near real time kind of stuff. Like I'm talking seconds, maybe even milliseconds in some aspects. Mm. So you can tell where players are getting stuck in your level, where they're dropping off. Maybe they're playing till level 4 and then everybody's getting stuck on, well, you have a level that you have to escape some slime or something that's coming up behind you. I'm just kind of throwing ideas out there. I don't know anything about this at all. But I mean, okay, let's say I have some kind of level where something's going on and it's a wall that basically people can't cross for some reason. There's some barrier. And people are kind of playing this, and after like the fifth time, they just get frustrated and bounce, right?
Yeah.
But if you have the data there, you can start to understand why players are bouncing, and also even more crucially, that players are bouncing. So you can kind of go, okay, this is a problem, we should fix this. And if you kind of bring this data into something like a heat map, so let's say you build like kind of a visual map of what your level actually looks like, and then you kind of map the data points that you're getting against there, then you can kind of see like there's a hot spot right here in the level. We should tweak this so that players can get around it. And like, if you can do that very early on and keep iterating on it, then you can build a game that's kind of uniquely yours and uniquely appeals to your player base. And it may not be a battle royale or a Souls-like or a, I guess the next craze is probably skateboarding games or something like that. Like, it may not be something that is specifically tied to that. It may be something that is uniquely yours, but it's something that you and your community have made together through using the data of how they play.
Mm. Do you think that's also why so many games are in early access now? Because this process is becoming something that's actually what games are about, that developers and community build together?
I'd say for the most part, yes. I mean, of course, there's probably games in there that are kind of, they've started building and they're building it over time and they want to keep the kind of money coming in as they build it. That's fair. But I think also there's kind of, yeah, cases where they are specifically building based on player feedback, where they'll build something, throw it out to early access and then say, give us feedback. Do you like this? Do you hate this? Should we make this blue? Should we make this red? And kind of tune based on that.
Yeah. I have a last bigger question for you, and then I would love to move on to my little quickfire questions. Okay. I'm curious what you think is kind of the meaning of games. Why are they so pervasive? Why does everyone seem to play them? Why mm-hmm. are people able to build such a ubiquitous gaming system, you know, through the likes of audio? And that, so yeah. It seems like everybody wants to be touched by games. And so developers or somebody like Amazon wants to have a high stake in games because, you know, Amazon is like kind of the everything store and games are part of that. And why are they everywhere? What's about it? Why is it so important?
In terms of Amazon or in terms of games?
In games. What's the meaning there?
So I think if you look at the stats, it's something like 2 billion people around the world. So like a third of the world's population play games in some way, which that's not necessarily going home and playing kind of deep diving into Call of Duty every night or, you know, playing kind of World of Warcraft or something like that. That can just be kind of playing 5-10 minutes on a mobile game every day. It still counts as gaming. I think people use it for different reasons. There's some that just want an escape. So there's kind of, I mean, obviously there are people that have kind of busy lives and, okay, maybe stressful or just kind of a lot going on and they just need to relax. And for them, games is a way of relaxing. That could be something like Animal Crossing, where people go and build a lovely island and kind of fancy up their house and all this kind of stuff. It could also be something like Dark Souls, where they just like getting hit with big hammers and big swords or something like that. Maybe. I don't know. I think there's that side. I think there's also a very strong challenge side where people want to experience new and interesting challenges, something that they just can't get out of the real world. I played the Tony Hawk's demo recently, the new Pro Skater 1 and 2 remake. And the warehouse level is super nice, really well done. Like, it feels exactly like the original one. I play it because I know that I'm never going to be able to like manual into it, you know, triple kickflip into it, like, you know, all of this kind of stuff. I'm never going to be able to do that myself, but like playing it in game is a ton of fun. So I think there's that aspect. I think it's just many of these people also grew up kind of wanting more interactivity than television could give them. So television's great if you just want to consume a whole load of content and veg out. And, you know, I watch a ton of Netflix. I love that kind of stuff. But there's also kind of people that are just like, I don't want to just sit on the couch and just basically eat potato chips and drink soda all day. But I want to kind of interact with the content in a way as well. And I mean, video games can give you that as well. So I think those are my main reasons of why I think video games are interesting.
Yeah, I think they're very good reasons. And I think everybody should consider them as a very important part of the technology and digital industry. They might be one of the key reasons why, what is it, Moore's Law or something, where the processing power doubles
every 2 years or so? Yeah.
I think you touched on it, and it seems to be a big reason. And it's basically, I have this feeling, since we talked before this podcast, I have this connection in my head that, wow, it seems like most of technology seems to be driven by some sort of games. You know, there's communication and Instagram filters and whatnot, but in a way, they're all games. Like, people play with each other. So it fascinates me, and I will need to think a lot more about that. For
glad
now,
to put that in your head.
yeah. You already put that there, and I'm very thankful for it. I have a couple of questions for you that I ask everybody on this podcast, and I would love to ask them for you if you're ready. It's a little quick fire round, so you know you don't have to be too brief, but try to be a little bit brief. Maybe we can breeze through them however you feel like. Are you ready for them?
One sec.
Yeah, take a sip. They are short but not always simple.
Okay.
And my first question is, what in your experience estimation is the purpose of your being?
Wow. It got deep. No, I think the places where I add value are more kind of bringing people together, looking into like their ideas and helping them kind of find the fastest way to experiment and bring those ideas to production. And then kind of keep them running once they're there. Am I perfect at it? No, no one's perfect at those things. But I think like that's what I find that I'm good at in terms of like, user groups, helping startups and game developers get started, helping them kind of understand what they're running. And I do that for many things as well. It's not just work stuff. I just have a habit of doing that. So
it's a good habit to have, I think. What inspires you?
I mean, challenges that seem impossible. Video game building is kind of one of them. So, I mean, how do you get, I don't know, either a team of like 5 or a team of like 200 together for a year to 4 years and somehow come out at the end of it with a product that your players love? Like, it's just a kind of process of going in one side and kind of all coming together as a group and just building something at the other side. I mean, that's awesome. Like things where you're kind of, I love kind of architecture as well, both from a like solutions architecture, but also a physical architecture thing. So like walking around cities and just seeing like cool towers and structures that people have built. And you're like, that must have taken years to build and plan and do all these kind of things. So I kind of just geek out on those.
Nice. So. True architect.
Yes.
Do you have books that you often recommend or give to people? 1, 2, 3, maybe?
This is a tricky one. I would love to read a lot. I just don't find the time. It turns out that like between work, Netflix, video games, and keeping up with friends, I don't have a lot of time to read. I tend to read more kind of graphic novels and comics and that kind of thing. Mm. And then read the more kind of nonfiction or fiction stuff when I get vacation time. So I think the things I found interesting are The Making of Karateka by Jordan Macnell. And also his second book in that series, The Making of Prince of Persia. So those are like his diaries from like those times and kind of him going from a student to like an actual proper kind of games developer. And it's just reading his diary entries of what he's doing. Those are really cool. And also I've been reading Batman White Knight recently, which is like a Batman series. I've blanked on the author, but the whole premise is that they realize the Joker has never really been caught for any crimes. And there's no proof that he's actually done any crimes. He's just menacing society. So they flip it around and say, actually, Batman's the one destroying everything. Like, he's the one driving his Batmobile across rooftops and all of this kind of stuff and causing all the damage. So then the police department go after Batman, and the Joker actually becomes sane and starts running as a political candidate. And it's kind of a weird story.
Pretty twisted to me.
It very much just flips the whole thing on its head. Those are the two types of things I'm reading at the moment: video game development and crazy comics.
Very cool. So, very cool. What is the change that you would like to see in the world?
I think I would love to see more people experiment with ideas. And I mean more kind of, okay, games or projects or things like this, that's fine. But I think there's also just kind of people wanting to do things in their own lives as well, where they're kind of like, this is a thing in my life that's really annoying. Like, I can't remember which bin I have to put the yogurt carton in or something like that. And having some, like, just kind of taking the extra step and going, this will help make my life so much easier. Whether that's just a case of them labeling the bin as like yogurt carton, or like building an app for people to kind of figure these things out, or just kind of stepping out and experimenting with ideas that might seem kind of silly, but might actually be useful in some way or another.
Actually solving a problem no matter how big it is, in a way. And how do you contribute to that?
I guess I tell people to do it. I think the thing is, like, often these things are very low risk to do. Unless you're kind of building something that is medical or money related or something like this, there's very low risk about kind of building a hobby project, or even at work kind of deciding to try something out as a new process or something like that. There's usually very low risk in this. So I think it's more kind of a, either do it quickly if you can and fail fast, or if it needs people to kind of buy in, then just kind of get the buy-in to kind of be able to get the data and then actually do it properly. But I think the key thing there is, don't be afraid to experiment.
Mm.
Especially if there's very low risk.
And I think in your role as the champion of the people, kind of helper, you do contribute to that. You help a lot of people actually solve their steps and bring them somewhere.
I guess, yeah, in some ways, yeah. Mm.
Have you lost anything on your way that you would like to get back?
I think probably the hardest thing there is like contact with like friends and family and that kind of stuff. Bouncing around the world is a lot of fun on one angle. Like, you get to see a lot of different places. And, you know, when you work in corporate jobs and that stuff, you often travel to many different places as well. So I've seen many cities around the world. I think kind of the hardest thing of, especially with moving countries back and forth, is like not having close proximity to family and friends from like high school and those kind of things. So like all of my immediate family live in Australia. My grandparents and aunties and uncles live in the UK. Bit easier to visit them. But like the Australian one, it's something like 28 hours on a plane.
Mm.
So it's a commitment. Like, and we stay in touch over Skype and things, but it's not like just going around to mum's place or dad's place, well, mum and dad's place, or like to my brother and sister's place or something like that. Like, just after work for hangout.
It's roots.
Yeah.
Get uprooted.
Yeah.
You do that.
So yeah. I think that's the main thing I've lost, like contact with friends and family, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What is something that you haven't done yet that you would like to do?
I think I want to just kind of have a crazy video game idea and turn it into a production game.
The Rise.
The Rise.
That's beautiful. I love that because it seems like such a logical step on your journey that, mm-hmm. that you might, I can, the way, the story that you told us, I can easily see you undertake that when it starts calling loud enough.
Yeah. I don't think it's there yet, but I think like I can definitely kind of, experiment as a hobby on the side and start learning the engines deeper and the tools and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the processes. And I think, yeah, eventually it would be fun just to kind of, like, even if it's just a me developing it myself.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like a 5-year project. If it eventually turns into something like Stardew Valley.
Yes, exactly what I thought. Exactly what I thought about just now. Solo
developer over like 5 years. If that happens, I'll be very happy.
You should be. You should be. Hey, I wish it for you, and I'm very grateful for this conversation. As always, you know, I would have loved to talk longer. There are many avenues to explore, but I really enjoyed geeking out with you here.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah. Thank you.
And I usually don't do this in this podcast, but because you're of a different guest, you're actually a community builder. You're very much in the deep end. I would really like you to throw out your Twitter handle or somewhere where people can contact you if they felt touched by this in any way, interested in working with you on something and so on. So where can people find you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter as just Mark Bate. MarkBate. And I guess for the AWS stuff, if you're interested in building with the games, aws.amazon.com/gametech, all one word. And then, yeah, there's a ton of different resources there on building your games.
There you go. So. Pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ja, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Mein Name ist Andrea Peters und ich bin Vorstandsvorsitzende des MediaNet Berlin-Brandenburg, dem Unternehmensnetzwerk der Medien- und Digitalwirtschaft in der Hauptstadt. In diesem Podcast wollen wir euch die spannenden Unternehmen und Persönlichkeiten aus unserem Netzwerk vorstellen. Wenn ihr auch Interesse habt, Teil dieses Netzwerks zu werden, dann geht doch mal ins Internet auf www.medianet-bb.de, ruft uns an, schickt uns eine E-Mail, kommt zu unseren Veranstaltungen und wir freuen uns riesig, euch dort kennenzulernen.